here today speaking with Dr. Truman Warner, an anthropology professor here at the university. We're talking about World War II and Dr. Warner's involvement.
In 42, just like so many other people, I received some notice in the mail that I was going to have to go into the military service.
Drafted.
I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about it, even though, and I don't know that anybody was, but they felt they had to do some of this thing. But I didn't. Well, I found some people who became gung-ho for joining up and so on, but a lot of people did not. As too much of a historian already at that time to be convinced that all the shenanigans we had been involved in Central America, in the Philippines, etc., 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 made us always on the right side. As I started to say, as the war went on and I got my draft notice, and eventually I was called into the Army, and with a whole group of people, young fellows from Danbury, we ended up at a camp in Oklahoma, Camp Gruber. And when we got there, it was out in the middle of nowhere, with a town at the gates of about a store and a few houses that looked like something out of the Grapes of Wrath. And we trained as a division. The doctors, I eventually ended up in the medics, in the infantry, 88th Division. The doctors who trained us, for example, were the people that we were going overseas with. Eventually, when we did go overseas, it was the first all-draft unit that went overseas as a unit. All right. Eventually, we got on boats, ships, went in a convoy. This was now November.
Okay, November 43.
And we're crossing the Atlantic. We were in a big convoy, a huge convoy. It wasn't very delightful, simply because so many people were crowded below decks. It would get hot, it would get at least a bit rough, you'd begin to get seasick, this kind of thing. We still didn't know where we were going. We just knew we were going across the Atlantic. Were we going to England? Were we going to where? We didn't know. We ended, our ship did, then it began to split as we got to the African coast, to Casablanca. And so for a couple of days at least, we traveled, and eventually we got to Algeria. Remember, we eventually ended up at a place called Magenta. Why I remember that name, I don't know. In some ways, this was a kind of interesting experience. In war, normally you hear all the accounts of all the battles and this kind of thing. Well, we had that too later. But to me, this part was also very exciting. Eventually, once again, we bought thousands of things.
Yeah.
We went on to Oran, which was the port. And once again, we were going to embark somewhere. Now, by this time, we assumed that it probably had to be Italy.
Right.
Because France was still held by the Germans. It probably wouldn't be Greece, which was being held by the Germans. Once again, we started out. And with a small flotilla this time, which smaller than we'd come across the Atlantic, and we didn't know whether a sub would find us or not. This is Sicily, and then we went on into eventually into Naples, and disembarked there, and then by stages moved up to the Italian lines, went into combat. Now,
you arrived in Sicily. I guess Sicily had already been taken by American forces.
Oh yes,
right?
It had been taken
and secured.
And we were a little. They were north of Naples.
No,
matter of fact, Cassino was still in the German hands.
Cassino, that was the
that
old
monastery
that we
so the to. Line, when we eventually joined it, went across Italy. But one pivotal area was Cassino, so you can tell about where we were.
Yeah. I always picture the medic as being right there on the front lines as this particular battalion or whatever unit that he's assigned to goes into action. Did you do that?
It depended where you were and what you were doing. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Since by this time I was a tech sergeant and I was working in the aid station, many of the times I was just behind the lines.
Okay.
In terms of as safe a spot as you could find, so that when you had patients come in, you could do something
about them. Right.
Well, no, that you weren't safe with them,
yeah.
But at least you weren't trying to treat them out in the open.
Right.
Sometimes you did that, and in this particular instance, as we went on the line, we were in place British troops, and we went in first of all with British helmets on, so that if the Germans were obviously trying to see whatever they could, they would not necessarily be aware that the British had pulled out and that new troops were in, particularly if they thought the new troops were new and
fresh.
And fresh and weren't quite ready and knowing what to do.
Right.
So, you know, I thought the Germans were around the next tree, as far as I knew.
It must have been pretty frightening.
Well, it wasn't
degree.
Comfortable. I wasn't terrified at that point, but I never did want to have anything to do with war anyway, so no matter what I did, I didn't like. But they were sending in shells. The first kind of shell I heard in my direction, because you could hear them off in the distance, were what the Germans called, the Americans called, screaming Mimis, because they had attached to them some device so that they made a screaming sound. In other words, to add additional terror to the fact that the shell was coming. And so we were stationed for a little while. In a village, if you went out of the village toward the north, you'd be right to see where the troops were, and the Germans would be just ahead of them. But we were in the village proper, simply because you had to have some kind of place where you could take care of people who were wounded. Now, you didn't always have buildings like that. Sometimes you had tents, sometimes you did it right in the open. But in this case, because they had been rather stationary for a little while, they had established an aid station right there. That's what we moved into. I remember going up in pitch black, dark. You didn't know who was. You didn't know. You know, there were ruined buildings all around.
Right.
And I remember going up and we'd pick up a litter and carry the body down to where you could get it to a vehicle or a jeep or something. You'd get carry it on back. So, and you got your patients out there, or you treated them as much as possible, as much as you possibly could. You gave them blood plasma. You gave them morphine. You took care of their wounds. You used sulfadiazine and sulfanilamide and so on, which were at that time, these were some of the early magic cures,
yeah.
Or at least preventatives.
Yeah.
And you had the sulfa drugs, and you would. But they were basically in powder form at this time, you see. So you'd open the tablet and shake this stuff into the wounds and then cover it up, try to clean it, cover it up, and try to keep it as antiseptic as possible. And eventually get them back to a collecting station. And if they needed further help, they would keep moving back in the various stages, so they would get back to maybe hospitals in Naples,
yeah.
Places like that.
They actually start breaking through the lines?
Start breaking through the lines.
The Germans put up a lot of resistance.
Yes, but I don't think at this moment they expected, they didn't know when it was going to occur, and I don't think they expected the enormous amount of firepower that was involved, because we had the artillery and so forth had been building up a tremendous backlog of materials. And the push started and the hour fell, you know, you just had this unbelievable bombardment of until it has flowed and flowed and flowed and flowed. You'd see it, some of it with so you could follow the streaks of light as it went, you know. Then there was a long, involved period of days and days and days pushing north.
And just marching.
No, it wasn't just marching. It was a lot of fighting on the way, and you'd stop and settle in for maybe an hour, maybe 3 hours. You don't know. You'd just set up, and maybe you'd have to move again. It was pushing and attacking and settling and pushing and attacking, and you were all dependent upon one another. You couldn't push too far here if Germans were still here and you got out in front of them. Anzio was already there, but it had been cut off. So north of us along the coast we had an area where we had troops in, but it was in terrible shape. They couldn't move out of it.
Right, you were kind of stuck and surrounded on
yes.
all sides.
Yes, and so one of the moves, of course, was as we were to connect up with Anzio, which we did. This was in May. I was with the division until August. By that time, we had pushed through Rome and were up at the Arno River.
Okay.
Florence, Pisa. And then I received an appointment and I went to another office.
Where was that office?
It was still in Italy.
Okay.
I went to an aircraft. It was a very honored, highly decorated Italian anti-aircraft black troops. But it is very typical of the army of that period. All the troops were black. All the officers were white, except the chaplain. I actually observed myself from a distance. I wasn't there. But I could hear the firefight going on one night in their camp.
Wow.
I could see the tracers going. Yeah. I was up on a hill above it. And
were fighting amongst each other?
Yep. Yeah. I don't know who, and I never found out, and I never went down to ask.
But it was...
Something went on. I don't know whether it was men fighting their own officers. I don't think so. Their own superior officers amongst them. It may very well have been the men taking shots at the upper level. I don't know. But I know there was terrible tensions in that outfit. And it was obvious why. I just moved in and began to do my job. In other words, I became like the assistant battalion surgeon, only I would be in charge of emergencies, obviously, but there was also an Italian surgeon. But I also had charge of all records, supplies, and so forth. But I would work with the men and all this kind of thing. And it was a great experience that I'll never regret having. I was with them until it broke up. Why did it break up? It broke up for a very simple reason. Aircraft in Italy became almost Italian, foreign aircraft became non-existent.
I see. Yeah.
And they had no reason for it. And so, typical army, we were eventually transferred to France. This was after the French invasion. I was in Anzio the day the southern France invasion occurred. And I watched planes in numbers go right. They followed up the Italian peninsula. And I was right on the beach as they went by. Droves. We didn't even know then what was happening, but we figured, and it was the invasion of southern France. But anyway, eventually, then we went to France. And eventually, our outfit was turned into transportation. I had received orders to establish a medical base depot company, whatever it was called. I have the slightest idea what you did. What do? You get this telegram. I don't even know who it came from the War Department in Washington, to set this thing up. I didn't know what you did. What do? Just run up a flag? So finally I found a fellow who had been a sergeant in charge of the records in some other outfit. He was assigned to us. And I said, what do I do? And he looked through the book and found out what you did. So somewhere maybe in Washington is a general order, which I signed, saying, I hereby take command of this organization, the 81st Medical Base Depot Company, at these coordinates. So we looked up exactly where we were, and I assumed command of an outfit. So I was a commander for about two or three days, and I waited for somebody else who ranked me to come in. And I said, okay, it's yours. You take care of it. We were in Marseille for a while, in which we worked with a large depot, medical depot, including all kinds of goods that were being scavenged from the war fronts, German equipment as well as American equipment. And we had German prisoners working for us, sorting these things, putting them together. I don't know that I accomplished very much there. I don't know who did. Particularly because one thing that happened was they would begin to use people for other jobs. And all of a sudden I found myself temporarily assigned to the medical, to the Marseille base anyway, in charge of that whole southern France area.
Yeah.
And I was the medical officer there, I mean, in terms of these kinds of things. I didn't want to be there. Nothing to do with it. Because first of all, it was one of these rear echelon places. The colonel in charge, this is with the war going on in the north, the colonel in charge would call a meeting at, let's say, 10 o'clock in the morning, at which everybody was supposed to, all the officers on that base, related to that, the base operations, were supposed to come and attend. And you had coffee, and you had people serving. First of all, I don't know why they were doing it, but I guess this is the old army, you know, and you're keeping up the standards. And I thought, and I was supposed to be in charge, this will kill you, and me too. I was supposed to be in charge, amongst other things, the whole prophylactic care of the men in the Marseille area. But I wasn't about to become that if I could help it. But nature stepped in. I got appendicitis. I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I was rushed to the hospital. And I was operated on. And I was recouping in the hospital in Marseille, there. And then I learned something, that a lot of people were getting recuperative leaves if they had been ill. So I said, I have been ill. I would like to take a leave because they were sending people to the Riviera. So I got permission, you know, grant papers, and I went to the Cannes at the Riviera and had a beautiful hotel room right on the ocean, right on the beach, in the Mediterranean, and spent, you know, several days there having a fine time, you know, eating in the hotel. I had to have food rations from the army, but nevertheless I ate there.
Still.
And I, met people and went off to Nice on a day trip and got acquainted with some nurses there, and we went out to dinner and this kind of thing. And I had a fine time. But to me, there was something ironic about this also. However, when I was in Nice, which is further up toward the Italian border, it was a very strange and eerie feeling. I was only there for a short time. I got transportation out for a little while, and then came back. To see American troops in jeeps, in their army fatigues, coming off the front line, riding in through Nice, when I was there on a recuperative leave. Dirty mud all over jeeps, and here I was spending a few hours in Nice enjoying myself, and these guys were coming off. See, it was right at the Italian border, coming in from France now. See, they were approaching, and I suppose at least setting up a barrier there. I don't know how much fighting there was, except obviously they were in the front lines, and they were covered with mud and dirt and everything else. got back to Marseille after this, and got there, and the whole outfit had disappeared. Okay. Got there, but they had knew that I was going to have the most problems, and so they had left a Jeep driver and a Jeep for me. But all my stuff was there, so I got back there, loaded the Jeep, and went on up to Lyon, where the outfit now set up was set up, and I became a worker in the depot that was rearming the French army.
It's like early 45 or
this
so.
This has to be 45.
Yeah.
And I was there working with the French parallel, and I had a great time. Because I got to know obviously the French officers, I had to work with them. And even though I didn't know French well, we got along, we did things together. Part of the time I was staying in a hotel. You know, we don't have great comforts, but it was very comfortable compared to what I've been used to.